This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Poshmark. Want to become a Blotter Presents tipster? Visit my Patreon page at patreon.com/blotterpresents.
One of the dead, Representative Leo Ryan of California. They'd gone to investigate a cult called the People's Temple, headed by a man known as the Reverend Jim Jones, and they were killed by members of that cult. Appalling as that was, it did not prepare us for what was to follow.
What you're about to see almost defies description, and some of you may not want to watch it.
Jonestown will return to the headlines next week with the 40th anniversary of the mass murder in Guyana, and Sundance's Jonestown, Terror in the Jungle miniseries takes an unflinching look back. And with both the MAGA bomber and Robert Mueller in the headlines recently, we're looking back at another series of attacks by mail. And another Mueller investigation with mixed results? With Frontline's The Anthrax Files. Powdered substances you really need to call your agent. This is The Blotter Presents, episode 75. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, devoted to the principle that crime is bad, but some of the stories about crime can be really good. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I've put a fresh pot on for my guest, Toby Ball. Welcome back, Toby.
I'm back.
He's back. Toby actually, as Edith Wharton would have said, put himself forward for our most wanted section this week. As I said in the intro, it's Jonestown, Terror in the Jungle, a four-hour, two-night miniseries on Sundance that begins airing, I believe, the 17th? Could be the 18th? We'll have it in the show notes. It's this coming weekend as you're listening to this. Again, that's on Sundance. And here's the case file on the off chance that you're a newborn or listening to this, having recently arrived from outer space. Here we go. The People's Temple Agricultural Project, better known by its informal name Jonestown, was a remote settlement established by the People's Temple, an American sect under the leadership of the Reverend Jim Jones in North Guyana. It became internationally notorious when, on November 18th, 1978, 909 individuals died in Jonestown, all but two from apparent cyanide poisoning in an event termed revolutionary suicide by Jones. The poisonings in Jonestown followed the murder of five others by temple members at Port Kaituma, including United States Congressman Leo Ryan, an act that Jones ordered. Four other temple members committed murder-suicide in Georgetown at Jones's command. While some refer to the events in Jonestown as mass suicide, many others, including Jonestown survivors, regard them as mass murder. As many as 70 people may have been injected with the poison, and a third of the victims were minors. It was the largest such event in modern history and resulted in the largest single loss of American civilian life in a deliberate act until September 11th, 2001. An unfortunate connection that we will explore later. Toby, why were you particularly interested in coming back on Blotter Presents to talk about this topic / event series?
So I think this has been a really interesting, it's a really interesting story. I was sort of aware of it. I took a course actually when I was getting my master's.
Oh, that's
in
right.
Cults, and we covered Jonestown. Actually, for Jonestown, I had to sort of lead the discussion, so I got pretty heavily into it.
Gotcha.
And recently read the big biography of Jim Jones that came out. That was super interesting. I can't remember who wrote it. So it's something that I know a fair amount about, and I've always found, you know, really interesting. And I think there is, you know, obviously the mass, you know, murder or suicide, however you want to look at it, gets like the most attention, as it should. But the whole story is really interesting, I think. And up until a certain point, like sort of a very American story, and then it goes way, way, way off the rails.
Which I think is also sort of very American. I agree with you. I think the gold standard for coverage of this, for me, is the American Experience episode, which I believe is called The Life and Death of People's Temple, which really gets into how everyone in Jonestown got to that point. And I am fascinated by, two things. The first is where the line was that was crossed. And I think this property, Terror in the Jungle, does a pretty good job of talking about the idea that there were a bunch of lines that were crossed, and that maybe Jim Jones was always over the line his whole life, which we'll get to in a second with a clip that I pulled. But the other thing I think this property does well, speaking of September 11th, like when I'm watching like documentaries about that, there's always this feeling of like when you're in the lead up to it, feeling like it could, not that it could still be stopped, like obviously it couldn't and wasn't, but that sort of like, oh, was this the thing that could have prevented everything, if that makes any sense? And there are a bunch of moments like that in this miniseries as well, that like when the news guy rolls up to Jim Jones and is like, yeah, some people have been passing us notes and they'd say that you're a megalomaniac and they want to leave. What do you think about that? Like, why, Don? Why'd you do that? I don't think it necessarily would have made a difference, but that there are those moments where you're like, narratively, but also emotionally frustrated by what occurred.
Yeah, I agree with you in that there are times when you're just like, don't do this, don't do this. Or why couldn't you have done that? And I guess we'll get to it, but it's the depiction of the scene on like the last day or two is really, really harrowing. And it's the people they have talking about it, I thought were remarkable. I hadn't known about Congresswoman Spear from California actually being there and almost dying as part of it. It's quite, I mean, there is this sort of sense of like impending, you know, dread or whatever. But they do a really good job, especially for that last period of kind of showing how things sort of cascaded.
Yeah, like I would say created suspense, but that's a little bit flip. But I think we're talking about the same thing, that they do effectively translate that atmosphere of just a sort of storm coming,
right?
Metaphorically. But they have excellent access to people who are present, to two of Jim Jones's sons, to various survivors who I have seen again in American Experience and other properties about this tragedy. It's based on a book by Jeff Gwynn, who is also in a lot of talking head interviews. And they also interview one of his childhood friends. And here's a clip about the idea that perhaps there was no stopping this train because it left a station during Jim Jones's childhood that was already inappropriately focused. You'll see what I mean in clip two.
In a small town like Lynn, Jim was a little on the weird side. Jim had his flair for the dramatic, and I think he enjoyed being dramatic.
He would recruit the other kids to come to elaborate funerals he's holding for roadkill.
I don't know whether it was just for its own sake or whether it was to freak people out.
All the boys in Lynn during World War II started playing war games, and they all wanted to be Allied soldiers. except one. Jim Jones was mesmerized by the way Hitler could have a whole audience enraptured, stand up and perform, and order people to do things, and they would do it.
I mean, yeah, like, I think a lot of people who are interested in history are fascinated by that effect, but perhaps are not
trying to emulate it.
Yeah, carrying it out into the world in a church. But then, you know, Jones ends up starting a church in Indiana, and it's the only integrated church. I mean, it bills itself as the only integrated church in Indiana, but I'm sure for a couple of states in any direction, that was still true. And then he moves the church to California and kind of has to sell the whole congregation on that. And a lot of them went with him. And then they're moving around a lot within California. I mean, not a lot, but enough. Like, I think I'd do one move and then be like, look, I came all the way to Ukiah.
Right.
I bought a house. Like, can we not? And then when it becomes clear to other members of the San Francisco power structure that that the boy's not right, he decides to relocate everyone to Guyana, very carefully choosing it based on, I guess, among other things, lax extradition treaties.
They kind of, so there's a lot. He had sent people down to Brazil to scout out locations,
right,
and hadn't found anything that was satisfactory. So the idea of going to South America, you know, I think kind of jungle environment where they could be isolated, was definitely part of his thinking. And then I think Guyana, like you said, and they mentioned in the show that he also liked the fact that they spoke English,
right,
that was helpful. Yeah, you know, they do spend some time on this. I thought they did a good job. I was worried that they weren't going to touch on it at all. Is this weird mixture of like very admirable in Jim Jones at the beginning, which was sort of a radical integrationist.
Yeah.
And, you know, he talks a lot about socialism and about sort of redistribution of wealth, basically. And, you know, you can have your own feelings about that. But I think all that stuff kind of comes from trying to lift up the least advantaged in the society. But then he combines it with this like absolute like hucksterism of, you know, these fake faith healings, where he's like, and they've got video of it where like old women suddenly can like dance around after they've been unable to walk. And, you know, they sort of briefly mention, but this thing about how he would, you know, claim to remove cancer from people.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into a little bit more in the book, but that is essentially, I think it's like chicken livers and some other stuff, which he like lets rot a little bit so it smells terrible. And it's just, you know, it's a stage act.
Yeah.
Where he does something and then he shows, you know, he shows what he's got. And so it's just weird, like even before he goes to San Francisco and starts to sort of gain like some political power, and starts to have sort of not ambitions, I think, to hold political office, but ambitions to be able to affect, you know, San Francisco and, you know, probably California wide in his mind, you know, social policy and things like that. You know, even before he gets to that, there's this weird kind of, you know, kind of split to what he's doing, which I think is really interesting. And again, it's like, it seems like sort of very American that those two things would go hand in hand.
Well, and apparently there is a term for this kind of socialism that is combined with churches, which is apostolic socialism, which is, I think, this sort of radical idea that's a very like New Testament constructionist idea. Please note, my major was not religion. I just have a bachelor's. I don't really know what I'm talking about. This is what I read. But I, like, unfortunately, given everything that came after, like, even if Jonestown had merely failed, because even the Guyanese are like, this is particularly bad growing soil, even for Guyana. Don't you want to live, so, like, don't you want to place the compound somewhere else? He was like, no, it's not far enough from the airstrip. But even if Guyana had, or Jonestown had just failed and not become this horrible massacre, you have to wonder where in the process the megalomania came in, because it's really hard to look at anything that he did in the 50s and 60s when it did still seem fairly utopian and idealistic. But after everything that comes after, you have to wonder if he didn't see his angle with people of color and marginal, like, you know, marginal joiners in terms of what he could get out of it for himself and how he could leverage their, I guess, gratitude at being included.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not a cult leader, so I don't really I don't really understand the thought process, but I did understand Animal Farm. And in clip three, when they're describing sort of the evolution of Jim Jones's socialism in the 60s and 70s, that was the first thing I thought of, is that however pure of heart it was in the beginning, it curdled.
I think Jim was a power addict early on. He was always watchful, trying to think how he could control People's Temple members.
When People's Temple has grown big enough, Jones can start teaching the real purpose of People's Temple.
The only thing that brings perfect justice, freedom, and equality, perfect love, and all of its beauty and holiness is socialism.
We were being introduced to socialism. Socialism meant that everybody would have the same. There would be no starvation. There would be no one going without any clothes. All the basic needs that a human being is supposed to have, they would have under socialism.
He starts encouraging communal living. And let's say in a house that might have been designed for 6 people to live, he'll put 12, 15, or even 20. And they'll sleep on mattresses on the floor.
That was so strange to me, but it felt good to sacrifice because the sacrifice was for the greater good. No one realized that Jim was using socialism to bring people in and control people.
I mean, yeah, because why would you?
Right. So it's, yeah, I mean, he does. Another sort of odd thing about all this is that in the midst of all this stuff, he's also taking from the classic sort of cult leader playbook where he has, you know, many affairs with women in the church. They take to corporal punishment for sort of transgressions, you know, both real and imagined. And they have
He sort of, yeah, there's this like Bacchante-ish structure to the beatings in which it's like this performative, like tent healing / casting out, but also, well, actually I have a clip. So let me get your thoughts on that after we hear clip 4.
Sure.
Why is it this way that you do this? I save you from worse than death.
That I was just pissed at the time.
I don't think you will change where you're going.
I mean, I know you're gonna kick my ass, but really,
John, get out of the way. Let the seniors have it. You punk, you damn gangland punk. You've caused us trouble week after week, month after month. Got my blood pressure boiling, punk mother.
I mean,
that's nice.
Yeah, like again, you see, first of all, classic, you know, hallmarks of abuse. and making it the victim's fault. There's a bunch of what I would consider dog whistling. Like, I just don't think that, like, I just think, yeah, that, you know, a white dude at that time, like, calling him a punk and, you know, and also expecting him to be grateful. Like, this is what I was talking about before. However pure his intentions 20 years before that, now he's leveraging his position and his, like, so-called ability to get people off drugs, except himself. We'll get to that.
Right.
Like, all of that just seemed very, I don't know, like, that read racist to me. And that it's definitely an example of the water temperature being turned up on the frogs of his congregation. Like, just all of these things that he would use his power to sort of step up the, to me, repellent, unacceptable conditions in the congregation. But he, I guess, did it gradually enough that it wasn't bothersome to people, at least while they were still in the States. That the situation once they got to Guyana is a different animal.
Right. So I'm not sure. I mean, it seems, again, like a lot of these, like the Rajneeshis and Scientology, and that there seems like there's sort of an inner circle that has this super intense thing going on. And then there's a larger group where it's still, like, intense, obviously. I mean, you see it in the film, but that they're not necessarily privy to the fact that they're sort of gang stomping people in these meetings, or Jones's infidelities, or, you know, the fake faith healing and stuff like that. So, you know, I can see where people who are just congregants who are showing up and seeing this sort of dazzling, charismatic, very sort of inclusive, highly emotional preaching that he does, can either not know or ignore this other aspect of things, which is a little bit darker, in which they may get more sort of secondhand if they get it at all.
Right. Right.
So, but it's tough. I mean, they, you know, to get him to go to California, he basically said, you know, there's going to be a nuclear war and we have to get out of here. We got to go to some place where we'll survive. And people are kind of buying into it. So he's got
in the event of nuclear war.
Right. So he's
got better off in Indiana, I would say.
Yeah. So that's, you know, I mean, he can throw like wild claims at them, that at people, that they'll kind of take, you know, I guess because he's God on earth or whatever.
Yeah. And I didn't clip anything that makes this point. But one thing I thought the show did well was to note that once everyone who is in Jonestown is in Jonestown and conditions are unpleasant and his drug-fueled paranoia is really, like, you know, the loudspeakers going day and night and they're being dragged out of bed to be berated, basically, in the middle of the night, and there's not enough food. I mean, he has plenty of food and he has enough money to buy them food, but that's not happening. But that the main reason that it was disintegrating sort of from a psychological structural standpoint is that they're around him all day with no perspective, and he's like getting sort of fat and bloated from the drug use and is constantly like licking his lips weirdly and You'll see that in the visual aids. That's on social media. Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. I tried to get a good screen capture of his very weird cotton mouth thing that seemed to happen a lot. But he could tell that now he's the man behind the curtain. Like, because they're on top of each other in this environment all the time, that there's kind of nowhere for him to hide. And that he, you know, the great and powerful Jones is actually just this, you know, fat
drug
addict. Yeah.
Yeah. And the, you know, and the way he deals with it, I think, is to kind of constantly ramp up the tension. So they have these white nights where he like tells them that there are, you know, there are people in the CIA is in the forest, and they take up arms and they do this weird, like, screaming into the night. And then they didn't get into this, and maybe I'm misremembering, but I believe that they did a bunch of sort of test runs with the flavor aid before.
No, I think, no, they mentioned that they did do,
oh, they did. Maybe I
they
missed
did
that
do at least one, which was a fake out.
There was,
yeah,
that one early on when they're in San Francisco and he gets them to drink like some kind of wine, and then he claims that it was poisoned. And he's like, ah, right. You know, actually it's not. But I believe that when they're in Guyana, like, that was part of the thing, was that, you know, I don't know how many times, but there were a few times when they basically were given the poison and said, not the poison, but the flavor aid. And it was claimed that it was poison, and they would, and it was like a test to see how devoted they were, so that when it came time to actually do it, you know, A, they'd been conditioned, and B, there was probably some sense until the kids started dying that maybe it wasn't real, except for the people who were, you know, right in there and heard him, you know, talking about, you know, is it quick? Is it painless?
Yeah, you're right. They didn't get as much into that, and the fact that he may have conditioned people to expect that it was a test of loyalty and nothing more. So, yeah, which is interesting. Like, I mean, I will say that this, compared with the American experience, which, you know, is very good and very affecting, but this one does avert its eyes from some things. And in the case of hearing all the audio from the end of everyone's days, that's a good thing. I didn't need to hear that again. I've heard it a couple times and it's really tough. Not that this isn't tough to get through, especially when, what is his name? Vernon Gosney.
Yeah.
I think the guy with the ear stretcher is talking about saying goodbye to his son, but then, you know, he thought he was just saying goodbye to his son. A lot of this is tough. Like, it was horrible what happened, but they don't, there are things they don't linger on as much. There were things that they skipped over, which I think is fine. That's, you know, that's not what they're trying to do. But I think overall it does a pretty good job of explaining how something like this can happen without, you know, with the knowledge that we're never really going to understand, because we're not, you know, megalomaniac cult leaders who are taking a bunch of cocaine. In clip five, they sort of illustrate the idea that if he wasn't going to be famous and lauded and go down in history for this wonderful utopian commune, then he was goddamn well going to put himself in the history books for something, even if it was horrible.
As Jim Jones realized what was happening at Jonestown was a kind of failed experiment, he and his leadership began to ask themselves, how can we still succeed in terms of history? And so we're an egalitarian community that's going to show the world how we can live as a utopian gathering of people, became instead, How do we show the world what a truly committed group of people would do if they are threatened with the disintegration of their community?
Yeah, well, we found out what one guy who should have been committed would do.
Right. So this is, you know, this is sort of the crux of what we talked about in the class, was sort of his, you know, he gets so concerned about people leaving, like that ends up being really what's sort of the, you know, it's the spark that sets all this other stuff going, is that people are choosing to leave. You know, why is that so threatening? You know, without coming up with like an actual, like, definitive answer to that. But I think it's hard, especially in a situation like that where you're so isolated and it's really just that group of people and there's nothing to distract from it, that the idea of defection is a failure, right? It's not, you know, if people want to leave, it's not utopia. You know, no matter how, you know, blinded you have to be to believe that in the first place.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's for me, it was a tough watch, to be honest. I mean, I think it was really well done. But it's, you know, the reality of what happens is right in front of you. I guess I haven't heard the stuff with the soundtrack of the final minutes or whatever, and I'm kind of glad I didn't. But it is, I mean, it's all, they've got it on video, you know, a lot of the things that lead up to it, and it's a tough watch, and it's tough listening to, you know, the survivors talk about it, particularly, you know, his two adopted sons, which is Jim Jr. and Steven, I think.
Yes.
Did you read that New Yorker article like years and years and years ago about survivors?
I think I probably did.
It's a long time ago. I don't remember it too well, but I do remember being kind of struck by the idea that these guys are all playing in a basketball tournament, and then they basically get the word that like everybody they know is dead. And yeah, like what a, you know, shattering moment that is.
And that they're on the radio being told that this is happening, and
right,
they have to do it too. And then the woman that they're with is like, she goes into the bathroom with her family and slits everyone's throats. I mean, it's not an easy topic. And there is some stuff, you know, the photos, even the helicopter shots of the aftermath.
Right.
Are rough. Just the way that everyone is face down with their arms around each other, there's, yeah, just something so heartbreaking about that. But then there are some like more graphic close-ups of Jones's corpse, for, yeah, instance, that are not for everyone. So be warned.
Yeah, they don't give you any warning either.
No,
it's like bang, there it is.
They don't. But yeah, there's just, like I was saying at the beginning, there's that like accelerating dread that it, with each successive thing that happens, you're like, just please leave, like grab everyone and some water and just run. But you understand not only why they didn't from their psychological standpoint, but the fact that Jim Jones set it up so that it would be as difficult for people to, in his mind, betray him by leaving as it could possibly be, as we're
right
in clip six.
People say, well, how could they stay? And a big reason is they don't have their passports, they don't have money to get home. A huge reason is that they remain dedicated to the cause. And if they do try to get away, there's the jungle. Jim Jones has them.
We're a happy family, yes, we are. All day long we sing a song.
And in the footage and in that where that song appears, they do seem, I mean, most of them seem fine. There's not that sort of, you know, we're singing along so we don't get
right
beaten dead eyes that you would expect. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, I absolutely don't judge anyone who didn't leave, because how could they, as we just right. heard? But there's part of me that always feels like, I just want that for them so badly, especially the kids. Like, oh my God, like, just to get a baby under each arm and run into the jungle. It can't be worse.
Right.
What's going to happen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, the don't drink the Kool-Aid. I mean, that whole expression, which I think, you know, pardon the pun, has been kind of diluted at this point. But
yeah.
The idea that it is this sort of, you know, full on acceptance of, you know, I don't know if it's a worldview or a philosophy or just whatever it is that how we want to describe it, but that you're willing to go to that step where, you know, in many people's cases, they're sacrificing their children, like themselves, in order to sort of appease this guy who, you know, and the whole problem is that they understand that he's not what he says he is.
Right. But that they also understand what he is, which is dangerous and in
right.
complete control of them. Like, I think the perception that there was nothing else that they could do.
Right.
Was everything in this situation that sort of, you know, aside from my obnoxious and inevitable, it's actually Flavor Aid correction whenever that expression
right.
comes up.
Right.
That's how it reads for me, is like, if you're drinking the Kool-Aid, it's like, you know, it's not a choice that you think you're making to go along with whatever program is implied by the expression. It's
right.
it's the sort of abdication of any control over what happens to you. And the fear of Jim Jones, I think, was extremely effective. And we'll hear that in our last clip, that Vernon Gosney, I think, really did want to leave and did his best to leave, but also was very realistic about the, like, how good the outcome was going to be for anyone in clip 7.
I met with Congressman Ryan and Jackie Spears. Congressman Ryan said, you have a congressional shield of protection around you. Nothing can happen to you. And I just thought, you're insane.
Yeah. Just something about the way he says that. You're insane. Oh.
Yeah. God. Yeah, you're not in D.C. anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that he became a cop.
Yeah.
That's so interesting in a lot of ways. But, of course, you don't really get into it. You just see it kind of scrawl across at the end. But
yeah.
I
would really like to know. I mean, I would watch a documentary about his – just him, like, reading from his journal from being a cop.
Yeah.
And also I would like to know what became of Willie, who seemed – I don't know. Sort of like funny. He's like, look, I know you're gonna kick my ass, but
right,
what do you want from me? Like, the kid was 15, and I think he was trying to explain, like, I'm 15 years old, what. So I hope Willie is okay. Willie, if you can hear me, let us know that you're all right. So compared to other materials in which you have steeped yourself. And I have also read Raven, which I thought was good,
mm-hmm.
not great. And an almost offensively terrible account from a survivor, Deborah Layton, who I think was married to Terry, to the notorious Terry Layton.
Yeah, the guy who shot who like jumped on them. Yeah.
And that one had the dead crazy eyes too, but I think he was Jones's like number two or three person. And it did not end well for anyone.
Right.
So that was awful. But in the like constellation of books and documentaries about Jonestown, do you think this one is like best in show? I think it's definitely worth seeking out. I've seen all four episodes. It's not a good time, but it's very well done, and I think honors what happened, for lack of a better term.
Right. So I haven't seen that American Experience. Is that what it was that you saw? So I haven't seen that, so I can't comment on that. I read The Road to Jonestown, which is what the talking head in this one. What's his name?
Jeff Gwynn.
So yeah. I think that's his book. And, you know, it's big. I mean, it's comprehensive. But I thought it was really, really interesting, particularly about the stuff that happens before he gets to Jonestown. And I think I think the two together are probably pretty effective, because I think the interesting stuff that this documentary doesn't have, you can get from the book. And then I think the documentary does, you know, it's not that the book doesn't do it well, but I think there's something about the way the documentary, I mean, they've just got so much film footage, and so I think you get a somewhat better sense of what was going on over the last, you know, 48 or 72 hours than you could through a book. So I think those two things, like if you're really interested in Jonestown and Jim Jones, I think if you did those two, you'd probably feel like you knew what you needed to know.
Agree. And we have talked about the American Experience episode on this podcast. I think it was like episode 4 or something. I will link to both that episode and the American Experience in the show notes if anyone is interested, but be warned, it can be pretty intense, at least on the audio tip. And there's absolutely no good segue into this section. So I won't try. I'll just say that I have an update on last week's Poshmark spot. Remember in last week's episode when I told you guys to keep your mitts off that $48 Coach handbag I saw on Poshmark? Thank you for doing that. It is now in my possession. And it was actually only $41, because sometimes when you like stuff on Poshmark, the buyer will send you a discount offer. But let's back up for a second. What is Poshmark? Poshmark is the easiest way to buy and sell fashion items. Poshmark carries women's, men's, and kids' fashions, accessories, bags, even makeup. They have a ton of brands to choose from: Coach, Obvi, plus J. Crew, Title IX, Doc Martens, whatever you like. And the prices are seriously amazing, like I said. You're browsing for millions of closets across America, or maybe you're putting your own closet on sale as well. For buyers and sellers, that's a cinch on the app or the site. Shipping is easy and super fast, and you can make sellers an offer if you see something you like and you want to save even more money. Or, like I said, offer buyers a discount who've liked items in your closet. You can see what I'm selling and liking by searching my Posher handle, that's Sarah D. Bunting, and you can save $5 on your first order. Listeners of The Blotter Presents get $5 off your first purchase. Just enter the invite code BLOTTER5 when you sign up. That's BLOTTER and the number 5 on Poshmark.com or the Poshmark app. And there's no good segue out of that either, so I'm not going to attempt one. We're just going to go straight into our cold case. We are talking about a Frontline episode from October of 2011. It's called The Anthrax Files, I believe. And here's the case file adapted from Wikipedia, the 2001 anthrax attacks, also known as Amerithrax, from its FBI case name. occurred in the U.S. over the course of several weeks, beginning on September 18th, 2001, 1 week after the September 11th attacks. Letters were mailed containing anthrax spores to several news media offices, including Judith Miller at The Times, and to Democratic Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy, killing five people and infecting 17 others. According to the FBI, the ensuing investigation became, quote, one of the largest and most complex in the history of law enforcement. That's probably partly their fault. We'll get into it. A major focus in the early years of the investigation was a bioweapons expert named Stephen Hatfill, who was eventually exonerated. Another suspect was Bruce Ivins, who became a focus of investigation around 2005. Ivins was a scientist who had worked at the government's biodefense labs at Fort Detrick in Maryland. On April 11th, 2007, Ivins was put under periodic surveillance, and an FBI document stated that Ivins is an extremely sensitive suspect in the 2001 anthrax attacks. On July 29th, 2008, Ivins died by suicide via an overdose of acetaminophen. Federal prosecutors declared Ivins to be the sole culprit on August 6, 2008, based on DNA evidence leading to an anthrax vial in his lab. 2 days after that, Senator Chuck Grassley and Rush D. Holt Jr. called for hearings into the Department of Justice and FBI's handling of the investigation. Because Grassley always got to be sticking his fucking head into shit in this podcast somehow. Shut up, Chuck Grassley. Okay, so the anthrax, I feel like the anthrax attacks are like connected to September 11th, but then weirdly, I don't really feel like I have a connection to them because I was living in Toronto at the time. So I happened to be five blocks away from the towers on September 11th, but then I went back to Canada, and a lot of stuff that was happening here, I felt a little bit of a baffle between me and that stuff. So I don't know how you felt about, like, what was your situation when this was all going on?
Well, I was living in New Hampshire, so, you know, we certainly were not the epicenter of all of this. But I think, like, all of the U.S., I mean, it was a time of, like, you didn't know at the time what exactly was going on, right? Was September 11th the beginning of a series of things? You know, even if it wasn't, what are the consequences afterwards? You know, there was, I don't think we'd identified who had done it by the time the first anthrax letter hit. So, you know, it was just sort of like another thing in this time of like sort of great uncertainty.
Right.
Although it didn't, you know, again, it didn't feel, they didn't feel of a piece, I guess, in that, you know, at least I didn't like think like, oh, you know, they're going to do the airplane thing and now they're doing the anthrax. Then what's next? Like, it seemed like it was something different enough, and like the effect that it would have was different enough that I guess sort of mentally I didn't sort of make that connection between them. It was just another sort of disorienting thing that was going on at the time.
Right, which does sort of make it that's another way in which it's relevant to today in, you know, in the sense that I at least feel like very disoriented at times by how much horrible stuff just keeps happening with apparently no weight but the brakes on.
Yeah, it was. And I think it's in some ways analogous to today. I mean, I think today it's just like you just don't know.
Well, today the, like, call is kind of coming from inside the house, but
right. But it's just like thing after thing after thing. And it's, you know, it's disorienting. And then, like, at least for me, it's like, do you have, like, do you trust the people that can do things about it to actually do the right thing about it? And, you know, what are sort of the unintended consequences that are going to happen? And right. So then this whole anthrax thing happens. And I think, they don't really talk about this specifically, but I think maybe you can read between the lines, but it was sort of like, they can't freaking figure this out. You know, this is like, you know, we can go and bomb some country, but there's not, you know, we're never going to like incarcerate someone for, you know, September 11th. It's like directly, I mean, we did, you know, get people who were sort of tangentially involved, I guess, but like, this is the opportunity to like have somebody in cuffs, for, you know, a terrorist attack, and we couldn't freaking do it.
Yeah.
You know? And like, the more you find out about it, it's, you know, it's gotta be a relatively small number of people like who have the wherewithal to do what they do with this anthrax, who have the ability to get their hands on that particular strain. You know, it's not, you're not having to cast a super wide net. But they, you know, not only could they not figure it out, but it was like Keystone Cops. And as I was watching this, I'd forgotten how much Mueller was in this. And yeah. I was thinking, you know, if I was like a partisan conservative, like I'd be sending this everywhere and be like, look, yeah, like this fucking guy gets somebody in his sights and he just goes after him until, you know, there's nothing left to do. You know, he went after Stephen Hatfill and, you know, for what, like 5 years or something until they finally, and they're like dredging lakes and,
yeah, and, all this and they stuff. Find this, but they're like, this is it. This is the smoking gun plastic box.
Right.
And then the,
it's a turtle trap.
It's a turtle trap. Yeah. Well, let's skip to clip 9 where they talk a little bit about the linkage blindness, I guess, for lack of a better term, that bedeviled this investigation from the beginning and for a long time.
Management was convinced he was the right guy. And so as a result, there were, you know, intense surveillance, bumper lock type surveillance of Dr. Hatfill that went on for months.
There is a brutal, sustained attempt by the FBI in these cases to turn or crack the suspect. And it doesn't look much like what happens on TV. It can be quite rough. And what they were doing to Hatfill clearly was an effort to create pressure in the hope that he would crack.
Another playbook tactic is search and seizure. Hatfill's apartment was taken apart.
There's something about this narrator, Will, I can't remember his last name. Sorry, buddy. That is, the disapproval is so faint and it's all the more devastating. But
yes.
I mean, how many fucking true crime properties have you and I both interacted with where this is the primary problem, is that law enforcement is like, no, 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 that's the guy. And they just won't get off.
Right.
Like West Memphis 3. Like anyone in either season of In the Dark, it just comes up over and over and over again.
Every episode of Nancy Grace.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Fucking Nancy Grace, whatever. That they're like, well, you know, he did this and he like, here's this circumstantial evidence. And it's like, all right, well, I can understand why he was a suspect up to a point, but then they're well past that point where they're like draining in an entire pond at a cost of $20,000 a day. And they find like a couple of old boots and some chicken bones and a turtle trap.
Right.
And Hatfill sued the government for $5 million and got it. Good for him.
Yeah. And you know, it doesn't quite come across here as it does in some, you know, articles I've read about this, but, you know, he was basically a very strong-willed, pretty egotistical guy who was sort of uniquely mentally prepared.
Yeah.
To be like kind of fuck you to the, you know, the Justice Department in a way that I think, you know, most people wouldn't. Like it doesn't necessarily end up the way it ends up with Bruce Ivins, but, you know, I mean, he definitely had the F you attitude towards the whole thing rather than, you know, being kind of worn down or intimidated.
Yeah. That he like called a press conference and went on the offensive and was like, no, I didn't do this. Leave me alone. Quit searching my girlfriend's house. And was like, come at me, bro, which I admired.
Nicholas Kristof.
Oh God,
like,
yes.
What the hell? Like
Sue Kristof too?
I don't know.
Because Kristof was Nancy gracing it up like relentlessly on the editorial page. He was going on TV and banging on about Hatfield being sketchy and very coyly calling him Mr. Z.
People who haven't watched, who haven't seen this, like Nicholas Kristof is the guy who identifies Stephen Hatfield, not by name, at least at first, but really is pushing the case in the op-ed page of the New York Times and going on CNN and all this stuff. And he really points the finger and he got it totally wrong, obviously. But it's a strange little thing. And certainly doesn't seem to have dogged him afterwards, really. I never got brought up with Nicholas Kristof. It's more about like, you know, the great things he's doing for, you know, sex trafficking survivors and stuff, which again is good.
Well, yeah. And I have some compassion for him given that this stuff went to his job and that he was even more, you know, had a sort of different level of intensity than the rest of us in terms of identifying and punishing a perpetrator. But again, you know, maybe someone like maybe his boss at edit board is like, could you just take a week, go to the country, think about something else. You're opening us up to a libel lawsuit.
Right.
Could you chill out? Like, I get that you're upset. This is, you know, you can't be doing this. So.
Well, it's what you said before. It's like this irrational confidence that you know who the person is. And then it's like, we're going to do the investigation to confirm it rather than let's take a look at what we got and see where it points.
Yeah. Like that's not how investigations should work. And certainly it's not how science works. And then, you know, they finally sort of tie the samples that were in the letters to samples that Ivins had access to in his lab. And then there's like this underground magma lake of ancillary fucked up that is happening with Ivins, as we'll hear in clip 10.
What we did find were kind of some unusual things. Like he was conducting a shooting range in his basement. He had numerous stun guns in things like that.
There's women's underwear found. There's guns found. There's all kinds of strange stuff. There's lyrics dedicated to Krista McAuliffe, the astronaut who died on the space shuttle. There's all kinds of strange little stuff.
They called Ivins to Washington for a formal interview.
The underwear was stolen from, I believe, a series of Kappa Kappa Gamma sororities. Like this guy was struggling with a number of substances as well. And I mean, but still, that's all circumstantial. Like the Krista McAuliffe lyrics just made me a little sad that it's like, what kind of, there's a bunch of sort of like weirdo half done projects like that, that if someone was searching my basement,
it kind of comes off like he's a weird nerd. Thus it seems likely that he did it. you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, the closest thing that they kind of trumpet is that the mailbox that he sent some of this stuff from was, you know, just a block away from some administrative office for Kappa Kappa Gamma National or something.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, I don't know. I don't know if I quite buy, you know, I think he's interested in sorority girls because I remind him of this one particular girl in the past. And I don't think he's all that concerned with like going by their administrative office. So, like that seems completely besides the point.
Well, you know, breaking in to and keeping trophies is like, that is extremely troublesome stalker behavior that seems inevitably destined to ramp up to like peeping, sexual assault. What, like,
these get him on that.
Yeah, get him on that. And the fact that he took his life, I mean, he could have, you know, that could have been a result of harassment of an innocent person. I think he was guilty of something, but I'm not sure what it is. And then the FBI, having sort of pantsed around harassing Hatfill for like 5 years, finally settles on this Ivins guy. And then when all is said and done, they're still not able to say definitively that he was the guy.
But he kills himself and doesn't, you know, can't speak for himself. So they're like, yeah, it was him. Case closed.
Yeah.
Did you see that picture where it's Ashcroft and he's flanked by Chris Christie and Michael Chertoff?
Yes.
Are like his deputies. I was like, oh, man.
I was like
these people never leave.
Well, as depressing as this was to watch in terms of the kind of consistent refusal of law enforcement across all jurisdictions to admit that maybe they're not looking at the right suspect, and B, like, it's just depressing. Like, this, you know, several people died. Others got really sick. It brings you back to another dislocated feeling time in the country, which is not great, but it's frontline and it's extremely well done. And they do an excellent job in 53 minutes economically laying out the crimes, the investigation, the problems with the investigation, the other investigation. They get a lot of different scientific and legal commentators to talk about it. They do not get Mueller to talk about it. Go figure.
It's clinical, you know?
Yeah. But
it's just like frontline often is.
But yeah, like we once on previously.tv, Tara and I collaborated on like frontline subjects that, or subjects that you think frontline can't make depressing, but they probably can. And it was like healthy kittens, big boxes of crayons,
right?
Sunset. And just we're just like imagining the narration by which Frontline would puncture all of your illusions about tiny felines and
the chemicals in the atmosphere that are making your sunsets.
Yeah. But I do like their companion podcast. They do a really good job converting it.
I haven't listened to those.
Audio. Yeah, actually, sometimes I look at the Frontline stacking up on my DVR and I'm like, not today, Satan.
Right.
But if you're in the car, it's an excellent way to get all that, high fiber Frontline information. And they do a really good job sort of audio captioning who's talking for you. And it goes down a little easier for me somehow than just sort of sitting in front of the TV and being, you know, confronted with reality. Who needs that when there's a new season of Real Housewives in New Jersey? But yeah, enjoyable is not the word I'd use, but this is, as usual for Frontline, a solid and informative 53 minutes, and I'm glad you brought it to us.
And we still don't know.
Yeah.
Most likely the person who did it's off, you know, living their life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's impossible, but again, we weren't given other options, and if he was ever going to say, he can't now. So,
right.
Yikes.
Awesome. All right.
Cheery. Toby, do you have anything cheery or otherwise that listeners should look out for from you?
From me? I don't know. I have some cheery tweets on my Twitter feed at Toby Ball NH. And I will have, I don't want to talk about it too much, but hopefully, beginning of the new year, I'll have a podcast project hitting iTunes and all those other things. Ooh. But I'll have more about that next time, hopefully.
And I will be joining you on your Patreon only podcast to talk about Bob Kolker's excellent Lost Girl. So folks, if you like Crime Writers On but you're not a Patreon subscriber, consider it.
Do it.
You can hear me and Toby talking about that outstanding book.
Yeah, this is not really a fun book either.
No, it's not a fun book, but it's extremely well done. Hopefully, also extremely well done, will be upcoming episodes, including my co-guest on a recent Balls Deep Dive Patreon-only podcast, Julian, who will be joining me to talk about Dirty John, plus Stephanie Green will come back to talk about the Believed podcast. Until then, if you've got a tip for the Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com. If you like the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. And if you don't like the podcast, don't tell a soul. My guest has been Toby Ball. He's on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.